Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, in with the mostest, with my cohorts over here in Fruta, Colorado, Mr. Richard Polinelli, and of course in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Ms. Bobby Jean Bell. Hello, guys.
Mr. Jim, how's it going?
It is, you know, in my feeble attempt to give this show a little class, I went with the minuet. And it's toe heel. So I mean, you know, if you want to get up and dance, Bobby, feel free.
Or, okay, I'll do that right now.
Or chair dances you've been known to do occasionally. we have a jam packed show tonight for you. Tonight we have, of course, our lead host, which is on the first Thursday of every month. Mr. Henry Parker is with us. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Bobby Jean. Hello, Richard.
Hey.
And what have you for us this week or this month?
Well, I'll tell you, there is so much going on, and much of it involves John Wayne, since he was born on May 26th. So anyone know what year?
1902.
1921.
No.
No, between those two. It's 1907 in Winterset, Iowa. Yeah. Well, anyway, there are all sorts of John Wayne events this month, starting with the INSP channel's Duke Days of May. They're showing John Wayne movies on Saturdays and Sundays all month, 18 in all, including rarely seen ones like In Old California and The Fighting Kentuckian. And keep your eye out for quizzes. They had me write at least 5 trivia questions for each film. And they were even kind enough to arrange for me to interview his son, Ethan Wayne, on camera. I don't know when or how they'll be using it, but I'll let you know when I learn it.
Okay.
Now, for all you runners out there, anyone run? I used to years ago. Well,
no.
But I got caught. No. Well, anyway, for any runners out there, on Saturday, May 7th, day after tomorrow, in the historic movie town Pioneer Town in the Mojave Desert, you can take part in a half marathon or a 10K. Part of the GRIT series of runs that benefit the John Wayne Cancer Foundation. Hmm. Yeah, and I've seen some footage of it from last year. It looks like an astonishing thing. You better be a good runner and not, you know, easily knocked out by heat or rocks and stuff. The where they're running is remarkable looking. Same Saturday, live events are happening again at the Autry. At 1:30, they'll be screening the Robert Redford-produced documentary, The Mustangs, America's Wild Horses, followed by a discussion with the film's co-directors. And at the Autry on Tuesday, May 17th, Rob Word's A Word on Westerns returns with a 50th anniversary celebration of the great John Wayne film, The Cowboys. Now, for anyone who doesn't know the film, when Wayne's ranch hands run off after a gold strike, he hires a dozen schoolboys to do his cattle drive. And Rob Word has corralled a slew of the kids from the film, including A. Martinez. He had to be interviewed in advance because he's making a film in Canada. But among the people that are going to be there are Robert Carradine, Nicholas Bovey, the kid with the glasses that Bruce Dern terrorized, Alfred Barker, who plays Fats, Steve Benedict, who plays Steve, Stephen Hootis, who played Charlie Schwartz, and Sean Kelly, who played Stuttering Bob. It ought to be fabulous. And back at Pioneer Town, from Friday, May 27th through Sunday, May 29th, it's the first annual Pioneer Town International Film Festival. By the way, does anyone know why it's called Pioneer Town?
It was started by What's his name? Who played Lucky in the Hopalong Cassidy films? Hayden Russell.
I'm sorry, who?
Hayden Russell.
Oh. Russell Hayden.
Russell Hayden.
Right. He was involved at the beginning, and Dick Curtis, one of the great villains of the Westerns, was involved. But there were also several high-profile investors in the place, and that included Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, and the singing group The Sons of the Pioneers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Pioneer. When it came time to name the place, Gene didn't want it to be called Roytown, and Roy didn't want it to be called Geneville. So they compromised, and they named it after the band, The Sons of the Pioneers.
Makes sense.
And incredibly, the current incarnation of The Sons of the Pioneers will be performing at the Pioneer Town Film Festival.
Wow.
As will the Dandy Warhols. It just sort of shows you it's a pretty eclectic mix. And among the other I hope so. Or I'd like to see the fight, either way.
There you go.
And among the films they're going to show, there will be the premiere of Jason Momoa's produced Western, The Last Manhunt, which is based on the same true story as 1969's Tell Them Willie Boy Is Here.
Mm. Mm.
And please check out the May True West for my article about a Western writer you guys may know. You know L.J. Martin?
Know of.
Oh, okay, well, when he got, like so many of us, tired of waiting for Hollywood to call, he not only adapted his novel, Eye for Eye, to a screenplay, he directed and financed the movie himself, and he got John Savage to star in it. And finally, I will be posting a new roundup this weekend for real, so I really mean it when I say you can read all about this and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Before you go, Henry, one thing.
Yes. Sure.
Pioneer Town. We used to take the horses up to Pioneer Town all the time.
Oh.
And there's a great restaurant right across from the motel, the Pioneer Town Hotel.
Right.
And I can't remember the name of it. But they have Western music and country music in there on weekends, and it's all like a log cabin place. It's really a cool place.
Hmm.
Right. It really is. It was a remarkable idea for a Western movie town, and they built all of those buildings that they had are practical buildings. So
right.
They could, as you say, make it into a motel so the people that were working on a film didn't have to find some other place to stay.
Right.
Oh, by the way, do you know why they built it specifically where they did, so far out of town?
I don't know.
Okay. It's, you know, people talk about the TMZ. But don't know what that really means. That's the 30-mile zone.
30-mile zone, mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the spot on La Cienega Boulevard, where the original movie academy was built, sorry.
Okay.
Their jurisdiction went from there 30 miles in every direction. And so if you got beyond that, you were not covered by the unions. So they wanted to be far enough out that they could do union or non-union productions. And in fact, I think the first thing they did of any size was the Cisco Kid series with Duncan Ronaldo and Leo Carrillo, which was shot in 16mm color, which was a non-union thing at that point.
Henry, was that part of why Melody Ranch was built where it was built? Do you recall? I used to know, but I don't. But I was thinking it had something to do with that, too.
It might have been. I thought that Melody Ranch was within that area.
That's what I thought.
Within 30 miles.
Within the 30 miles.
Yeah.
Within the 30
miles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. Pioneer Town is 27 miles out of Yucca Valley. Straight up the hill. Straight up the hill. You can't miss
it. All right.
Anyway.
Okay.
Thank you, Henry.
Well, thank you. Have a wonderful show, guys.
And we'll talk to you in June.
I look forward to it. Have a great time, folks.
You too. Thanks for calling in, Henry.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Tonight's show is brought to you, of course, by us. And we have a guest tonight. Her name is Marilyn Creech. Kind of chronicles her life. From, I'd say, 5 or 6 years old up to her early 30s. And it encompasses quite a bit. We're going to get into that just right now. So if we welcome for her first shot on the Writer's Block, please welcome Miss Marilyn Creech. Or Creech. There we go. Hello, Marilyn.
Got it. Thank you. Thanks for pronouncing it right.
Well, you know,
easy mistake to make.
People call me all kinds of things. We aim to please and oftentimes get it wrong. But hey, it's you know, it's our show.
Well, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
No worries. Why don't you start out by giving us a little bit about Paradise Road, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so Paradise Road is a memoir, so it's all true. Of course, as I get to choose the truth, but anyway, whatever is in there really happened. And basically, I had a pretty unconventional, especially teenage years, childhood and teenage years. I ran away from home when I was 14, and this was just at the 1970. I was kind of chasing the hippie dream, and ended up being on my own at 16. And first of all, going into a couple of juvenile detention centers, and then landing in a girls' home run by Catholic nuns. And they sent me out into the world at 16 before I had finished high school and I started working. And anyway, the heart of the story, though, is kind of my search for love and belonging, since I didn't have it at home. I had a really difficult relationship with my mother. And I was very influenced by the hippie scene and by the Beatles in particular. And so I fell in with kind of the university crowd and met somebody who I believe was the love of my life. And he and I set off on a bicycle trip to South America, riding from Canada down to South America when I was 21 and he was 8 years older. Unfortunately, tragedy struck and he got cancer and he died before the trip. We were able to finish that trip. And so I was so shattered and shocked and stunned by his death that I had no plan B for my life. So what I did is I got on my bicycle and started riding off by myself and living in my tent and having adventures and searching for meaning and love and belonging, whatever, on the open road. So that's really what memoir's about, and it's actually is where that story ends. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Okay. Kind of regressing a little bit. You mentioned the fact that you had a hard time with your mother, and not so much your father, but your father wasn't around all that often. And I had problems with my mom. I think in that time period, I was born in 49, but I think in that particular time period, parents really didn't understand parenting. I think a lot of the parents were still trying to get through World War II. Fathers came home; they were screwed up. They had delayed stress, just like everybody else. And a lot of them never got over it. My dad never did. My dad hid the military for 24 years. But he never really did get over his World War II and Korea experiences. I think a lot of the people that I've talked to that were elder, that were in World War II, this was way back when my parents were still around, they all pretty much said the same thing. The demons that they fought weren't necessarily their family. They were still fighting the war.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the family got involved in the way. Mm-hmm. I think more in the way than anything. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of mothers weren't very well liked. And Bobby Jean, I know you absolutely adored your mom.
Oh, yes.
But a lot of mothers felt like they were being persecuted when they really weren't. And a lot of them took it out on the kids. Mm-hmm. Because they were the ones that were home, because that was the days of the mothers stayed home, the fathers worked, and the mothers were stuck. Well, my mom had five kids, well, six actually. And I know we drove her insane.
Yeah.
Not on purpose, but you know, kids are kids, and their kids are going to do stupid kid things.
Yeah.
And as you outlined in your book, you did stupid kid things. So
Yeah, I did. But yeah, my mom was definitely, my parents were probably a little bit younger than yours. I was born in 56. My dad didn't go to war or anything like that, but they were born during the Depression and grew up in the 40s, I guess. Mm-hmm. But my dad was a school teacher and then a principal, and he was pretty tied up with his work and seemed to, I always felt like he gave his best energy to the kids at his school. And, you know, I would hear from his students how loved he was and how funny he was and how much they enjoyed him. And I'm like, that's not the father that we get at home. We kind of got leftovers, at the end of the day. I think for my mom, I share a bit of this in my book. She was very frustrated, I think, to be, like you said, stuck at home. She also had five kids. She wanted to be a singer, and I don't know if that ever really would have happened with or without kids, but that was her dream. She loved music. And so, but she ended up having the four of us like kind of back to back to back and quite young. And my memory of her, she was always kind of angry and frustrated and not a very happy person. And for some reason, I was the only girl of the five kids. And for some reason, I was her target. I definitely got the worst of her anger. And she told me quite young that, she, you know, when I was about 9 years old, she told me she didn't like me as a person. She'd love me as a mother, but even that was questionable. I grew up knowing that my mom, you know, was not my friend, not my fan. She felt like my opponent, really. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my appears with her away with things that she wouldn't let me do and things mm-hmm. that other kids were allowed to do. I wasn't trying to do outrageous things, and it just reached a point where I was in so much tension that anytime I had to, like, as soon as I started heading home from school, I was just in knots, knowing what was waiting for me at home. And I really couldn't take it anymore. I felt mm-hmm. like I can't deal with being this target and mm-hmm. feeling like I was always in the wrong and always in trouble and not knowing what I was going to get in trouble for. So that was my situation.
Gotcha. We need to take a real quick break here, Marilyn. Don't go away, please. Sure. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. We'll be right back after this brief word from LA Talk Radio.
So you want to be a radio talk show host, huh? Well, why don't you get off your butt and do just that? You see, at LA Talk Radio, we've got slots available all day long, Saturdays and Sundays included. They're 50-minute increments, so all you have to do is go to latalkradio.com, go to click on the link that says Become a Host, follow the easy-to-follow instructions, and Mr. Sam Hassan will be more than delighted to walk you through everything you need to do to get your own radio show started, up and running worldwide with a podcast to follow. That's very easy to do. LATalkRadio.com. Let them help you get your dream alive. LA Talk Radio, you've got something to say. Now let's hear it.
And we are back with our guest, Marilyn Kreet.
Okay.
And if you want to call and talk to Marilyn, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. Bob Jean, you notice I'm not reading that off anything. Yeah, number is 323-203-0815. We're talking about, in reading your book, I got the distinct feeling that not the first bike trip you took with Jack, although mm-hmm. The story itself was, it was like, wow. You know, when you fall head over heels, you fell head over heels.
I did. Totally did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the second bike trip you decided to take on your own was your catharsis to make yourself find something you were looking for that didn't exist at that point in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was also like I share in my book, it was kind of like a test I gave myself because I felt like I had to do something challenging and hard for some reason so that I knew I could survive. It was kind of like a, mm-hmm. like if I can survive this, I can survive anything. Mm-hmm. Because really it wasn't something that I thought, I'll take a bike trip, that'll be fun. It was more like,
right.
What would be the toughest thing I could imagine doing? And the toughest thing would be trying to do this trip without Jack, without my...
Sure.
My riding partner. And so,
sure.
Yeah, I set off full of, a lot of fears and trepidation the second time. Not sure if I could even, not sure if I'd be able to even cope with it.
Yeah. So, I got the distinct impression reading your book that you continued to look for that one thing in your life that was going to make your life whole.
Yeah. So, I think for a long time, it was trying to replace the relationship that I'd had.
Okay.
But even though I kind of knew I'm never going to find another person like that, you know, I think that the more I tried and the more I searched, the more empty I began to feel, and more sure. touch, I guess, I got with my emptiness.
So, okay, Bobby, go ahead.
Hi, Marilyn. This is Bobby. I finished reading the book about 45 minutes ago, just before we went on the air.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I had started it early in the week and had gotten about halfway and then thought, I can finish it Thursday. And that's kind of what happened. The title of the book is Paradise Road, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us how you decided to come up with that title?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, good question. It wasn't the first title. I had several titles, as I was writing it, then none of them really felt like they were the title. I think one of the later chapters, when I'm writing by myself, I actually found myself stranded for a couple of days in a little place called Paradise, Montana. There might have been some kind of town there. I never even discovered the town. I was just kind of, that was a place on the map, and I was stuck camping on a hill in the rain. And, the irony of it was like, this is supposed to be paradise, and I'm feeling completely lost and stuck and confused and lonely. But that was a kind of a pivotal moment. That part of that story is very pivotal in the changes that came about in my life. So I really got the paradise came from that episode of my story. And then as I look back, I thought, the whole, it's kind of a journey. The whole story is a journey. It's kind of, what happened as I ran from thing to thing, person to person, crisis to crisis or whatever. And it was a road that ultimately brought me to a good place. So I felt like Paradise Road would kind of fit that journey. Although life has not been pure paradise ever since. I'm not saying that, but it got better.
Well, I'm really happy that your bear turned out to be a big raccoon.
Yes. Yeah, the bear's made it twice on her fear list.
I know. Huh?
Yeah.
First one, last one.
Yeah.
Well, that was a smart raccoon. It knew how to zip and unzip, right?
Whether they just know how to do that instinctively or whether he had to practice somewhere else. I don't know.
Those creatures are professional thieves.
They have they have fingers and hands, so they can. They're very dexterous and they can do a lot of things. I know the bear thing because we used to go horse camping up in Yosemite.
Yeah.
And they have the bear boxes there.
Bear boxes. Yeah.
The big steel bear boxes plus the high lines. For the horses. Yeah. And you can hear the bears at night. They're rummaging through they're trying to get to your food. They're in your camp.
Yeah.
They're all over the place. And, they tell you, if you have a camper, stay in your camper. Don't put up a tent.
Yeah.
That's horse camp.
Yeah.
Well, so I stayed in the camper. I wasn't going to put up a horse tent or a camping tent with bears around.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, and I always knew when a bear was around, not only could we hear it, but my horse, I had an Arab horse at the time, and she'd start snorting. She didn't whinny, but she'd start snorting. I could hear her snorting, and I knew, uh-oh. And of course, you can't take guns into Yosemite, so stay buttoned up in the trailer.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
The funny thing I was just going to share is I've changed a lot over the years, and the last, we moved to the Vancouver area. A place called Coquitlam in about 2003, and there are just tons of bears in that area. They're kind of, and because the city is kind of growing into the mountains, the bears are being displaced, and so they're walking around the neighborhood. They're everywhere.
But, right.
So in the years since I'm a daily hiker, biker, or whatever I like to runner, or whatever. So I've encountered so many bears now on my hikes and my walks and my bike rides, and they don't bother me at all. Like I'll walk past them. I'll say hi to them. I'll tell them that, chill. We're good. Like they don't freak me out at all. In daylight, it's different too. Right. But, my husband is the one who's got the fear of bears now. Like he doesn't even want to go on the trails when he knows it's bear season. And I come home and I'm like, hey, I got to see two bears today. I got to see three bears today. So, yeah, so that's kind of, this kind of changed with me. But
well, I was in your town one time, and that was probably in the late 70s.
Yeah,
and it was a I don't remember why I was there. I think we were doing a some kind of a show for some guy who was skiing. He was a musician. He was skiing and shattered his leg, and okay. It was like a whole bunch of people that were there. But we were staying in this kind of like shoddy motel. It probably isn't even there anymore. But in the morning, I woke up and I was going to walk across to the cafe and get some coffee. And there was a bear in the dumpster pushing it across the street.
That's funny.
Was that a $3 motel?
Yeah, and half the time, well, they had them back then. And half the time, the bear's ass was just hanging out of the dumpster, and his feet were dangling, and he was in there. He was dumpster diving. He was big time dumpster diving. Yeah. But I'd never, and I didn't have a camera, and I'd never seen that before or since.
Yeah.
But it was the funniest thing.
Yeah.
So no That's coffee.
Good. That's a good one.
The bear woke me up.
That's a good one.
Richard, you want to get into a little process?
Well, yeah, I actually, you know, when you're writing a memoir, it's different from when you're writing a biography, because with the biography, you found a subject that is of interest to you. You want to tell that subject story. When you're into memoirs, you're going into your story, and I'm wondering what prompted you to dig into the past and tell your story?
Good question. You know, it's something that I knew for years and years that I was going to write this book one day. It was just like in me. It's like I just knew it was a darn good story. Like I had a lot of strange and interesting and unusual things happen to me. And it had a natural narrative arc to it. And yeah, that was part of it, was just wanting to share the story itself. Part of it was wanting to share about Jack, because he was such a key person in my life, and I was only with him for a couple of years, but I wanted other people to know about him. And so part of it was kind of a tribute to him. And part of it is just, I love to write, and seems like I'm a memoir writer by nature. I've actually got 3 more memoirs coming down the pipeline. So I'm not done yet, but I just felt like it was a story worth telling. And so when I finally had time in my life to sit down and start writing, it was very, very gratifying to be able to do that.
Yeah.
How long did it take you?
The writing part of it, writing the first draft, I probably finished it all less than a year. I set myself a write 2,000 words a day kind of goal, and I just set to it. And you know, I had a few false starts. I didn't quite know where to start it and what to include and what not to include, especially with the part about my childhood, because I read tons of memoirs. I love memoir. I'm a big fan. But I do read some that I feel like you get way too much detail about kind of boring childhood stuff. And I didn't want to bore my readers with, you know, stuff that was interesting only to me and my family. So, so that part probably took a little while to kind of get off the ground and figure out how I wanted to handle that part. But once I got into kind of the meat of the story about the running away and the rest of the story, it flowed pretty naturally. And then, of course, there's the, you know, the editing and the revising after that.
Well, sure.
Yeah,
Richard and I do that all the time. So go ahead, Bobby.
I have a question. It's so detail rich without being boring by the details. But you give us, even on the cross country kind of adventures, you know, you take us day by day, where you were, what you were doing, what you were eating, how you met different people and so forth. Were you journaling all this time? How were you able to recapture so much and be able to share it?
Yeah. Well, another great question. You know, I wasn't journaling. I think I did have a journal with me at some points, but I've long lost. I don't think I had that journal for longer than a year or two after. So I didn't journal, and I probably think I was writing my feelings and my thoughts about Jack more than anything. I probably wasn't writing about this is what I did today. So I didn't have any notes. I really didn't have any photographs. I had nothing but memories. But one thing I think two things. I think one thing is that we retain and remember things that have emotional import to us. And I think so much of the story was very emotionally engaged in a lot of it. So the memory was quite easy on that end. I remember a lot about how I was feeling, thinking at different points. I certainly didn't remember day by day. I couldn't tell you every single day what I did by any means. But I did, you know, details stood out about, you know, people that I met or places that I were. And the other thing that helped me was I have a good memory for the names of places. So I got on a map for both trips, for the trip that I did first with Jack when we were riding through the, you know, Canada and the East Coast. I got on a map and started looking, you know, kind of trying to retrace the route. And I was able to do that quite well by remembering the names of these little obscure little towns that we stopped in. And again, I couldn't remember details about each place, but there were enough places I could remember that I could, you know, I could kind of say, yeah, I remember being there. I remember that name. I remember, you know, walking in the streets that night or whatever. So it was kind of I think just working with maps and working with emotional memory was most of it. Yeah. I was actually a little scared when I started writing. I was like, will I remember enough? Because I didn't have journals or notes or diaries, or photos. But because I think I was so engaged with that part of my life, that a lot of things kind of stuck, a lot of memories stuck.
Yeah. We need to hold it right there for just a few minutes. And we'll be right back with you after this brief word from Tuscany Bay Books.
Hey everybody, Richard Polinelli from Tuscany Bay Books here. And if you're an author and you've just finished your manuscript, you just got the easy part done. There is editing, formatting, cover creation, marketing, the list goes on and on. But don't panic, because we're here and we can do all of that for you so that you can focus on the most important thing, writing your next book. And if you're a reader looking for your next great read, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com. We have books for the kids. We have mysteries. We have thrillers. We have westerns. And we have some of the best science fiction being written by award-winning science fiction authors who will tell you an entertaining story, not send you to your therapist with message fiction. So again, readers and writers, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com and get ready to set sail on your next great adventure.
And that's it for Richard Polinelli and his t-shirt. Sarcasm is what he does.
You know what? Real quick, while we're on the Tuscany Bay boat here, I want to. News and information in your email once a week.
There you go. Okay, we are back with our guest, Marilyn Crete, and we're talking about her book, Paradise Road. And let's get into a little process now, Marilyn, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
I usually kind of withhold this question for a little while, but I think I'm going to go ahead and spill it on you.
Go.
Do you oftentimes stop and reread and go back a chapter or two and make sure everything is following the way you want it to go? Or do you just go all the way through your first draft and then go back and work on it?
Yeah, I write kind of the way I kind of picture myself writing is almost like I'm stringing beads along, colored beads along a lines of string or whatever. Like I feel like I'm writing word by word. I don't dash through a first draft like a lot of writers do. I do it all on the computer, and I'm writing on the sentence level, and I kind of place my words and my thoughts pretty carefully as I write the first time. So that's kind of my process. I'm not super fat. I don't just dash through it. I think through it. And that'd be for the day's writing. And then before I carry on to the next day's writing, I always go back and reread what I wrote. And if I feel like there's edits I want to make right then and there, I'll do that. So So honestly, by the time I finished the drafts of, like, I've got three finished and one halfway finished now, there wasn't that much editing to be done because I kind of do it all as I go. If that makes sense.
Yeah, we do.
But I do. Yeah. I have a lot of writer friends that I think, you know, they just sit down there so they can just get it out. Just, you know, I think Stephen King's a big advocate of just get it out, you know. Just don't stop and think about what you're writing and, you know, let the words flow. And my brain doesn't really work that way. Maybe part of that is because I'm not writing fiction. I'm not having to make up stuff. I'm trying to record what happened and how I felt about it.
Right.
It's kind of I kind of write in a thoughtful way, I guess, is how I put it.
Bobby, go ahead.
The book is in, we read it in chronological order. Mm-hmm. When you were writing it, was it coming to you in chronological order, or, you know, one thought might lead to another thought and you might remember something that was 2 years later from where you are? And, you know, did you scribble that down so you wouldn't forget it and then
you know
feed
what?
It
no,
in?
No, it wasn't. It was very chronological. And I know, you know, I know the trend today in writing memoir and books is like, you know, don't do chronological, you know, start, move it back and forth in time or whatever. And, you know, with my book, I'm like, I really saw it as one of the things that I don't know whether you picked this up with you read it, but I saw my story as a lot of it is a chain of relationships. There's from, you know, my best friend Laura, and then my friend Norma and or Cora in the girls' home, and then my relationship with Blair, and then my relationship with, you know, I was going from relationship to relationship. Mm-hmm. So that made it very chronological in terms of what I was going through at each point, who I was with, and how that influenced me. I think when I was, as I was writing it, I was kind of just staying and living in that period of time that I was writing about for however long that, you know, those chapters took. So it did come out very chronologically. And, I don't remember, like, you know, going back and saying, oh, I forgot about this and putting it in. It kind of just came to me as I was writing it. And another really great surprise was just realizing how much when you start to write about and remember, stuff will come back to you as you're actually writing, you know, details kind of show up. So
conversations as well.
Yeah. You know what? I don't have a great memory for conversations. I can remember like a pithy saying that someone said to me or one sentence they said to me or, you know, some statement they made. And I don't know if you'll notice this. I don't have a lot of like pages of dialogue in my book. I can tell you kind of with the gist of what was being talked about or said or whatever, but when I do include dialogue, it's usually just a short bit, and it's usually what I clearly remember somebody saying, not what I'm reconstructing. So I don't have reconstructed conversations. I really wrote down, like, I remember this person saying that to me. I remember those words, and that's what I included.
Okay.
So unlike a lot of memoir, I read a lot of memoir where there, you know, some people are really amazing at dialogue and a lot of their writing is in dialogue form. I'm not really that writer, I don't think.
Well, I think you're probably, what do you think, Bobby, the third writer we've had on that was a memoir?
I can think of three for sure, and there might have been
like
one or
Richard
two
brought up Bianca
others.
Murray.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there was the one, the gentleman that was homeless in, there was a family that was going through the loss of the dad from cancer that lived in Pasadena.
Actually, off the two, freeway.
And the fabulous where they're going down the rivers, she was the wife of the gentleman that wrote the book about Peter Hook, about Dr.
Captain Hook.
Captain Hook.
Captain Hook.
Oh, that book was, I think that was in the war, you know.
And we also had one that they moved to Beverly Hills and the dad was I just can't remember the name of the book.
Yes,
so I think we had about five or six.
Cocktails, something about
Jim was drooling over the Mustang that was listed that was talked about in the book, you know.
Yeah, and you know, they've all been each one of those really, you know, the memoir writer really allows us into the intimate moments of their lives. I think that takes a lot of courage.
I was just going to say, Bobby, and this is going to be aimed at you, Marilyn, is that you mm-hmm. did such a job with this book that the question when you're reading a memoir, and I think every reader, we're going to get into readers in a minute, but every reader that reads a memoir, I think they start out, why does this matter to me?
Mm-hmm.
And you make it matter. You make it matter because you tell the story so distinctly, but so personally mm-hmm. that it kind of forces you to care about the writer or the person who is telling the story.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. It can be, I think it can be stressed.
Yeah. Well, I read a lot of memoir and I read a lot of reviews of memoirs. I love to go on Goodreads and see what people say about different memoirs. I did that a lot as I was writing, just to sort of to avoid some of the traps, right? See what, you know, people didn't like a memoir. What did they not like about it? Staying true to my own voice. But one thing I have noticed is sometimes people kind of just take a dislike to the protagonist, to the memoir person mm-hmm. telling the story. Maybe because they just seem like they've got a bad attitude or grudges towards people, or they kind of present themselves as a victim, or they just keep making the series the same mistakes over and over and over, and the reader's kind of like, okay, you know, like,
right.
Learn from. I think that's always a risk when you put yourself out there. It's like people are going to kind of judge you for your life choices and as well as, you know, maybe how well did you write the book?
Yeah, well, I think there's a big chance because people don't know you.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, and you're, so when you're putting your memoirs down, I personally think that you have to really make it where people want to care about you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you have to have a story worth telling, like I said, a story worth telling, right. Whether it's harrowing or funny or just unusual or, you know, unexpected. Yep. I think that's part of it. And I think, but I think the other part of it, I think, is the voice and the tone behind it. And I think, you know, a lot of people have commented with Paradise Road, there's, I'm not laugh out loud funny, but there's humor in it. And there's kind of a wryness in how I tell a lot of the stories. I'm kind of looking back at myself and saying, what a doofus I was. Like, I really thought that. I really, you know, especially the teen year stuff.
You're set up huge hope. And it's the hope and making us see your loss was cathartic for me because I've lost family members now and everything else. And, you know, to try to soldier on sometimes is a little rough. And I can see where you were with Jack and I can see where you were grasping at straws after he died. Yeah. And finally coming out the other side as a whole person.
Yeah.
And I applaud you for that. Now, I have to do one more commercial real quick, and then we're going to get in. I'm going to have Bobby ask the question tonight, the question.
Okay.
And then we're going to get into readers. So we'll be right back. This is LA Talk Radio. We'll be returning shortly right after this brief word from Creative Edge Publicity.
Okay. You've written a book. How are you going to get your name out there? Well, the folks at Creative Edge Publicity will. That's their job. They aren't going to sell your book. They don't want to sell your book, but they will take your brand from the ground up so you are known in your genre and within the writer's community. They'll do this by using relationships with contacts they've made in TV, in radio, podcast, and publishing to get your name and your brand recognized. So why are you waiting? Contact Creative Edge Publicity at www.creative-edge.services or email Mickey Mickelson at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com. Creative Edge, it's your work and it's your brand. Why would you trust it to anyone else? Creative Edge Publicity.
And we are back with our guest, Marilyn Crete. And I'm going to leave it to my also charming friend Bobby Jean Bell ask his question.
Should we ask every episode, Marilyn? Do you get writer's block? If you do, how do you get around it? And if you don't get it, what do you think about it?
Oh, wow. That's another great question. Well, as I said, Paradise Road was my first memoir, and right after I finished it, I jumped into my second memoir, which picks up my story 20 years later. And as soon as I finished that one, I started my third memoir, which I ended up living for a couple of years in Bombay back in the mid-80s, and I wanted to tell that story. And then I finished that, and I've lived for 6 years in Africa, and I wanted to tell some stories about that too. So as I'm writing those stories, I don't get writer's block at all, because I've got the material is just in me, and I just need to get it out on the page. I can't say that every single day that I write is like, whoa, I'm just, you know, churning up gold here, but never experienced block as I was writing those books. Having said that, I'm kind of at a point right now where I've kind of stalled on my fourth book. I just could have put it on the shelf a bit, because I wanted to do some other things and help promote my book and stuff like that. I haven't got back to it yet, and I have kind of hit a block in that. I'm kind of thinking, what do I do after that one's finished? Like, I wish I had a novel sitting inside me, but I don't think I do. So part of me is like, I don't want to finish the fourth book, because I want to have something that, you know, I can always go to and write when I want to write. But yeah, when that's done, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with myself. So.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about readers for just a minute. We kind of threw this into the writer's block about a month ago, and each writer has a different opinion on what they're doing. When you write, what do you want your readers to get out of your memoir? But what do you want readers to get out of what you're telling them, the story you're telling them?
That's a tough question. As a writer, well, first of all, I want to make readers think a bit, maybe about their own lives, maybe points where they resonate or feel like this is really different from their experience, but maybe get them thinking about their life and their relationships in a different way. I also just want to entertain. You know, I love picking up a book that I can't put down, and I hope that I can write those kind of books too, where people get engaged in a good story and kind of take them on a journey. Because I love finding books that do that for me. And my second memoir is kind of heavier and deeper. It's about delayed grief and complicated grief and some PTSD thrown in there too. And so that book is written more with, I really want to help people that are going through the same kind of trials and struggles to have some light and some hope and, you know, maybe encouraged by what I've learned. So.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And with that being said, if no one has anything else, we are out of time. It's amazing how quickly this 50-minute rolls by, especially when we had Henry.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. And we want to thank you for participating. And from Canada, being a Canuck.
Thank you so much. You read my book. That's even better.
Well, we actually do. And that was the deal we made when we first started the show, that we would read the books.
Yeah, that makes all the difference, honestly.
I'm sure it does, especially to the author. But we loved having you, and we hope that you'll come back and visit again. And with that being said, it's now. Oh, I love your town. Incidentally, you have a great little town. I've only been there that one time, but it was a wonderful place to be. So.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So next week we have writer Alicia Dill. I don't know what she's written, because the book you would be sending out the books tomorrow. She's not up to snuff, but I'm not going to be with you guys next week. I'm playing hooky next week. But Richard and Bobby will have the helm, and they'll be interviewing Alicia Dill. And, of course, as for Bobby Jean Bell and Jim Bell, Richard Paulinelli, Cheryl Paulinelli, my favorite person, Sam Hassan and his lovely wife, Dina, myself, Jim Christina, and, of course, the bookie, without whom the show could not and would not be possible. We are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.